In this episode, we talk to owner of Digital Frontiers Media, Stephen Barker.
Is Drupal 8 really a plasma hologram? Would you like to know more?
And the difference between being a tech evangelist or a tech martyr.
Thunder! 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 Thunder!
Welcome to the Thunder Nerds, where we're always right on top of that rose. My name's Noun Forever, JD Wright.
And I am Brian Hinton.
And I am Frederick Philip Von Weiss, and you are listening to the Thunder Nerds, a conversation with the people behind the technology on the front line of design and development. And I believe in this episode we're touching on some Drupal-y things and reminding Sue Ellen that every girl over 25 should have a cucumber in their house.
I'm right on top of that rose. Okay.
That's highly accurate. I gotta tell you though. I'm remiss. Do web good. I can't hit the table now. I might be a little downtrodden, a little distraught. I don't know.
We'll talk about it.
I'm gonna have to live with this for a second.
Just suck it all in. Suck it all in, as they say to the French. Suck it all in.
They don't have to tell the French to suck anything in.
No, exactly. You get it. You know what I'm talking about.
Exactly.
So let's go ahead and introduce our guest today. We have owner of Digital Frontiers Media, Stephen Barker. Welcome, sir.
Thank you. Hello, guys.
Hey, welcome.
Hey.
I'll tell you that I almost did a cable guy because I was like, Steven, and I looked at your name and I was like, that can also be Stefan.
Yeah.
I'm going to hold off on that one because, let me tell you, I really did want to do a cable guy thing. And then Fred had already got to me and so he goes, no, it is Steven. And I was like, well, I've already committed.
Oh.
Do you get that confusion sometimes, Steven?
Yeah, every once in a while. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I am actually pretty impressed with the your research team because identifying where I went to school and everything like that. It's you guys were doing your homework.
Well, we have a group of 50 that go through this for us.
Yeah, that's what I figured.
Yeah, and well, I mean, and by that he means I was just outside of your bushes for about a week solid, just, you know, taking everything in, listening to arguments that you had with loved ones. It was a very interesting time.
The photos are excellent.
Yeah, I bet.
They are.
High quality. And seriously?
Vector.
Sexy.
Vector, really.
Yeah.
Vector. Blow those things up whatever size you want. I'm having blankets made.
I want to duvet personally. So talking about our research and all the stuff that we looked up about you, Stephen, and Jonathan's bugging of your house and taking sexy photos of you, let's go ahead and jump in and talk about some of that research. Let's start off with where you went to school. You came from California and you went where?
No, actually I spent most of my time here in Sarasota, but then,
oh really? So you grew up here?
Well, since I'd say 1990 on, I've been off and on living in the Sarasota area
since Kurt Cobain was a thing. I got
yeah.
You.
but yeah, I so
the
I,
age of flannel.
Yeah, I ended up going to CSU East Bay, mostly just I got, you know. Computer programming used to be my first love. Like, that was what I did in high school. And then I kind of got distracted by bikinis and marine biology for about 17 years. And then I was working at Moat Marine Laboratory here in Sarasota.
I love the process of this. It's like bikinis.
And
yeah.
How do I get closer to bikinis?
Yes, exactly.
Marine biology. How do I make money out of this perversion?
Yes.
I know. Moat Marine.
Uh-huh. Well, it wasn't just sexy. Like, remember, like, the 90s weren't just Kurt Cobain. It was also like Dilbert kind of came into play in the 90s, and that was kind of the future that I saw that I did not want, sitting in a cubicle under fluorescent lighting. So bikinis on beaches sounded much better to me.
So Baywatch.
So what do you do now?
I sit in a cubicle under fluorescent lighting.
Yeah.
Don't resist Dilbert.
Yeah. So yeah, the thing is, like, so working at Moat Marine, they have some cool programs. They did like distilling the science that the scientists were doing down to elementary school level. And so the program I was a part of was taking that science and making it readily available in different forms of media for the elementary school kids. And it was like doing that work that got me kind of back into media in general, digital media in general, because it was just incredible the power of media to take like what is typically a pretty dry subject. I mean, scientific white papers will put you to sleep, but you take that same information and wrap it up with some, you know, some cool graphics and some clickety-click interactive items, and everyone just, like, you know, kids get excited about it. And so that's what kind of got me back into it.
Okay, so how did that translate into you going to California?
Because I had no formal training in multimedia. You know, I was just like, I was just faking it. And so I was like, you know, this stuff is cool. I should really learn this. So I ended up going back to school over there. They have a really cool program there. It's, you know, like it was at the time I was thinking of Full Sail here in Orlando. It's in Orlando. Mm-hmm. Have you seen their program?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's pretty freaking incredible, but at the same time, it's pretty regimental. And CSU, they didn't have like the outstanding, incredible, over the top budget, but it was more like an Imagineering sort of program. Like anything that you kind of wanted to pursue, you could, you know, work it out somehow, you know. So that's
what they need to change. They need to change their slogan to Full Sail, the theater of the mind.
Yeah.
Hmm. I like that. It's catchy.
Mm.
So where did you go from there then? How did you get into what you're doing now?
Well, when I graduated, I was, you know, thinking about the direction I wanted to go was to create multimedia or interactive experiences for zoos, aquariums, and that sort of thing. But, it being difficult to find that kind of client initially, I was just like, okay, first of all, I need a website for my business. And someone suggested Drupal. And so I started using Drupal. And at first I thought it was cool. Then after a while, I hated it. And so that's kind of like I started doing that. And I was like, well, someone said, hey, I need a website done. And I was like, well, you know, I just did this Drupal thing. I guess I'll do it for somebody else and for money. And Drupal has basically been a part of my life every day since 2007. Yeah. So
websites, websites and sex work. Websites and sex work is literally how those two statements come out. You know, I did it for myself, and then I just thought, you know what? Somebody asked, and I just said, fuck it. I'm going to do it for money. Uh-huh. Let's just go. I mean, that's the only two things. It's one of the only two things where that actually comes through.
Yeah.
So were you a LAMP developer before that, or did that kind of reverse technology yourself, if you will, into after learning Drupal to become a LAMP developer?
Yeah, I mean, that was it. It's just I needed a website for myself, and Drupal was open source. And this was, I mean, when I first started, it was Drupal 4.7. And I went through the Drupal 5 phase. And I think Drupal 6 was kind of like where I really started digging in, because up until then, I was just poking around and doing the pointy clicky thing. But yeah, Drupal being an open source project got me into LAMP development.
Hmm. So in your development, what does your tech stack look like? Are you using MAMP, or what exactly are you using to dev in?
No, it's mostly all LAMP. I mean, I have a Mac at home and I do run MAMP, but for the most part, I feel, you know, more comfortable in the LAMP environment. The thing you know, Mac under the hood is close enough that, you know, it makes it easy. So I understand, like, from a number of my Windows friends that they often have to fight with a lot of their development workflows. But I understand that some of that stuff is going to be a little better here coming soon. I think there's some talk about Docker being a hell of a lot more easier to kind of control on Windows machines coming up.
Yeah, that Bash is on Windows now in the next version, which is going to be awesome.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot more things now, I think, even in Windows 10 that are first-class citizens. So are you more now of a PHP LAMP kind of guy, or do you kind of practice any of the JS stuff? Are you a participant in the JS wars at all?
Yeah, so, yeah, I can...
JS wars.
It's true.
I do mostly PHP and JavaScript. The thing is, like, initially, I remember seeing websites where people were like, yeah, JavaScript's not really a real programming language. And it's amazing to me just how JavaScript is the language to know. It amazes me because we also have been doing mobile application development since 2009, somewhere around there. And initially we started doing stuff natively in Objective-C. Yeah, and so what we were having a problem with was that, you know, you'd write all this code in Objective-C and they'd say, hey, now we want it on Android. And I got tired of that. And luckily that's around the time a lot of very smart people were putting together things like Accelerator, Titanium, and projects that used a common language like JavaScript and had interpretive libraries that would interpret it into the native languages. So that way you just have one code base for your client and you don't have to worry about, oh, I have to add a new feature on this side, so I have to figure out, you know, and port that over into Java on the other side and stuff like that. So JavaScript has just, like, you know, it's more a part of my life than I ever thought it was going to be.
Yeah, have you tried React Native at all yet?
The what?
Have you tried React Native yet?
No, I have not. Although in the Drupal world, there are some lively discussions about choosing and implementing an official front end framework. React, Ember, and Angular, I think, are some of the ones that they are looking at specifically.
That's cool.
You mentioned something earlier and you use the word we in the sense that the Queen uses it, so I would like to touch on that. When you spoke about we, I'd imagine talking about Digital Frontiers Media.
Yes.
When did that get created and how, and what do you do there?
Well, it was when I came back from school and I was looking for people, you know. I don't know if you're familiar with the Hub here in Sarasota.
Yeah.
So interestingly enough, that was kind of this. I had the same sort of idea a similar idea, I guess I should say, as far as like not necessarily having a traditional sort of company, but having a loose band of networked freelancers that kind of would work together on projects, you know, ad hoc, you know, committees, I guess it would work on these projects together. And that's kind of
like freelancers in the same building.
Yeah.
I think they call those 1099 employees.
Yeah. So that's kind of,
you just call it 1099.
Yeah. So that's kind of the direction that we went initially. And then we started expanding and we had regular W-2 employees, but, I've mentioned to Fred already, I'm kind of in a weird place in my career, and I'm looking at other things, but we can talk about that later.
So what is your day-to-day then at DFM? What exactly are you doing there?
Day-to-day?
Yeah.
Right, well, for the most part, like I said, Drupal has been like a part of my life every single day, basically since 2007. And just handling our client requests, adding new features, developing new modules for clients. It is the day to day. I mean, as a I wouldn't say that I'm a sysadmin, but I kind of see my role as being the support person for our other developers.
Yeah, know? That's what I was more asking, because since you're the owner, I don't know how much that you're actually, or let me be more specific, our listeners don't know how much you're involved in actually the development side of the company, or mm-hmm. is it more an admin role is what I was getting at.
Yeah, so I mean, I have to wear many hats. It's a small company, but I kind of see myself as being I am typically the lead architect on the projects, and most of the smaller tasks and some of the challenging tasks get delegated. But then what happens is that as soon as they hit a block, like we have a project management system, a lot of my time is just putting out the fires or breaking down the stumbling blocks, you know, that are kind of hampering the development for the other developers.
Hmm. Yeah, it's huge. That's the thing about that is like, I mean, Fred and I and Fred more than I have worked for companies where not only does the owner not know a damn thing about it, like they're completely not involved, but they try and to know nothing about something and get out of the way of it is one thing. Mm-hmm. Like, you know that like you can make money and say, oh, okay, well I can make money and I hired what seemed like the right people, my clientele's happy, I should probably get away from it. And then there are those owners that don't know anything but still want to play in it. You know what I mean? It's like, I've never baked a souffle in my life, but I think that we should add, like, sugar and salt and why not paprika?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, no, stop it. Like, just get the hell out of the way and let us make you money. You know, that. But no, it's got to be amazing for them to be able to be like, hey, boss, I'm going through something and it's a struggle. And you're like, all right, well, let's roll up our sleeves and get in it.
Yeah. And that's the thing is, like, I do believe very strongly in getting out of the way, but I don't want anyone to sit there and struggle if, like, I can be of help and I can, like, you know, like, we have me and one of my developer compatriots, we have what's called the 20-minute rule. And that is, if you're sitting there spinning your wheels for more than 20 minutes, you need to, like, you know, get on the horn and ask me or ask the other person in order to, you know, see it, do they already know a solution to this or, you know, something, because otherwise you're just wasting time. Obviously, if your developers, if you get out of the way and you have them working on something challenging and they just, like, step right through it all the way to the end with no problems, you know, it's more profitable for everybody, but and less frustrating. But if they hit a wall or something, I want to, you know, get that wall out of the way as quick as possible.
Yeah. Well, it also saves you money too, if you can plug in. The more time you plug in, the more money you save.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Keep moving forward. Very smart. Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of moving forward, another great topic I'd like to talk about. I saw on your website and in your YouTube videos that you've done AR and VR work, including, it looks like you did some Microsoft Surface work. Really curious to hear about what it's like working with that tech and how you develop for that.
Yeah, actually, we didn't do any Microsoft Surface work. What we did is, and this was for my master's project when I was at CSU. We built so this was 2004 through 2006, and this, like, remember the iPhone came out in 2006. It actually came out, I think, right around the time that I was finishing my project, and a lot of the touch screen, or I should say multi-touch stuff, wasn't available. So what we did is we had no budget, and we wanted something that was kind of like a Microsoft Surface table, which at the time I think was selling for 20 grand or something like that, a pop. And we built one with, like, a webcam and an overhead LCD projector and the whole thing for like $1,500.
Wow.
Yeah. Using basically like OpenCV computer vision libraries to analyze what's on the table. We actually had a transparent or semi-transparent surface on the table, and we had a camera underneath the table that would actually read content and things that are being placed on the table and identify them and track them.
Wow, that's very awesome. I mean, are you still doing VR AR work or at all, or do you try and get into it or experimenting on the side?
Well, that's the thing. Like, okay, so that was like, I got so into it. Like, my first, I built my first augmented reality project in 2005, and our project was done in 2006. And it, I had like an augmented reality game where you tried to land a moon rover on the surface of the moon.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, I mean, it was cool stuff. I mean, it was low-res graphics. It was a little while ago. You know, that's, 11 years ago? 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Crazy to think that.
Yeah, but after a while, I tried very hard to kind of, like, get people interested in augmented reality, and I was definitely an evangelist for it. I wrote a blog post in 2009, which I really saw as 2009 being kind of like the year that augmented reality is going to break out and it's going to be everywhere. And while it did have some commercial success, it didn't, you know, I was still explaining to people in 2010 or 2011 even, you know, what is augmented reality. And it's just like Pokemon Go is like all over the place.
I was about to say that.
And it pisses me the hell off because it's like, it's 5 or 6 years too late for me. I kind of like after, you know, 10 years of talking about it and, you know, I just could not get the traction or the people that interested. I talked to places and they either didn't have the budget or they didn't have the vision to understand how it could be used and stuff like that. I actually had a game idea in one of my project thesis ideas in 2005 was for a project called Spiritual Reality, not spiritual. It was like virtual, but spirits. And it was based, it was very much like Pokemon Go in that it was kind of a geocaching thing. You would, find Native American spirits in like the trees, the rocks, and the things around you, and they would tell you origin stories, and then they would say, hey, you need to go and talk to Red Bird about, you know, this or that. And so
that's kind of cool.
I mean, it was going to be kind of like an educational slash, you know, like geocaching augmented reality thing. I have a video online somewhere, you know, where I kind of like had the original proposal in it. Ooh. But it's like, Pokemon Go, go fuck yourself, you know.
the problem was is that you weren't an evangelist. You were what I like to call a martyr. Like like if you're talking about 2007 and so that technology, like anybody who has an idea, I think that's so far ahead of its time isn't really an evangelist for something. I think they're a martyr. They're gonna die on the idea, like on the cross of that idea. Because the thing is that you can have that idea, but if technology isn't caught up to you, or at least technology like popular technology isn't out already.
Yeah. Popular technology.
The idea is going to die.
Yeah.
I mean, it was February 26, 2011 is when you should have started getting excited about augmented reality, because that's the day that the 3DS came out. It is the world's best-selling handheld, as far as a video game device, that's arguably trumped now by the iPhone, because of, you know, gaming, some games being popular. I mean, I think Pokemon Go right now is making somewhere around about $4 to $5 million a day,
mm-hmm.
which is small potatoes. Crazy. Compared to it. Well, no, it's
a little more than what I'm making.
It's small potatoes compared to other games like Hearthstone and other things like that are out. I mean, Hearthstone I think is making somewhere between like over like $10 million a day or something like that on just like microtransactions. So it's but they did that with there was a haunted game or like a augmented reality game that came out with a 3DS where you were going through your house and it would like find ghosts, but it was basically like you could go into situations and like you'd see them. It was kind of like the scare you, but you had to like cleanse the house or something like that.
Oh, that's
but, like,
cool.
Anytime you find that stuff, and it's like, that's why, I mean, that's why it's like, you're kind of like an army vet, and so at that it's like, you know, I was there. You know, it's like, dude, we get that you were there, but now we don't have to do war in trenches. We can actually just sit behind the screen and like blow things up.
Yeah.
Like that was the thing. It's like, you've got to wait until the popular technology catches up with the idea. So those people that are like, augmented reality is the greatest thing ever, all those people have gotten out of that business. You know, and then it's like, and then somebody comes through, some young buck that never knew what it was like in 43 came up and was like, yeah, this is obviously the right, it's like man moment machine. It's the right time. So, I mean, evangelist, martyr, I don't know.
Yeah.
You seem a little salty.
Yeah, I am. Because it's like, there's all these ideas I had. It's like, well, shit, I couldn't get anyone to listen to me. And now it's like, oh, wow. Yeah, let's go and do that. Yeah, I mean, this actually, it's funny because this earlier this year, there were some really good videos that were out using like the HoloLens and some other things where it's like, this is the year that I saw when I first like experienced augmented reality and when I built my first augmented reality experience. This is the year that I've kind of been waiting for. As far as like the technology and the future that I saw is here now. I mean, it's not 100% readily available to everyone right now, but it's damn close.
It's in the right price point. I mean, now I think you're looking at Sony VR being like $399.
Yeah.
It's $800. And if anything, if truth holds to form, when you talk about video game systems coming out and then the degrade in like what they're worth, when you look at the original PS3 launched at like somewhere around like $800-$900, and it very rapidly dropped down to almost like a $300 price point within about a year or so. So
yeah.
You'll start to see these VR technologies. Eventually, they're going to go after the people that really, really want to get on the cusp of it. But then they're going to realize, shit, we need to make money. So let's go just slightly above production costs so that we can actually move units.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Hey, Steven, speaking of new technology, I know Drupal 8 is getting a lot more adoption lately. Are you working in D8 or are you still a D7 guy?
Well, most of my clients are D7, but I started looking at Drupal 8 a couple of years ago when their first alpha releases, when they first like started building, you know, making the D8 working D8 core available, and it has come such a long way. I've got probably only half. I mean, I'm by no means like deep into D8 like some people I know. I've got maybe about half a dozen sites that I've worked on, only two of which are kind of production and or production ready. One of them was for a client that just dropped off the face of the earth, so it never actually went to production, but it was a good learning experience. There's just so much cool stuff in D8.
Well, why should anybody go ahead and upgrade to D8 from D7? What's the big attraction? I mean, to me, I could see that there might be trepidation in jumping from those versions, since you probably have a lot of the modules already readily available to you that you want to use in D7, and maybe some of those things aren't available yet in D8.
Yeah, that's definitely a factor right now. I mean, supposedly this... if you follow the metrics, at this point in the equivalent point in Drupal 7's adoption is less than what you're seeing in Drupal 8. Drupal 8's adoption rate is way higher, and there are so many good things that are in Drupal 8 that it will behoove people to move to it, especially right now. I mean, with the release of Drupal 8 and a couple of months on top of that, you know, Drupal 6's end of life came out. It's going to be imperative that people kind of move and upgrade their systems, just because the surrounding infrastructure, no one's going to continue to maintain servers that are running antiquated versions of PHP and that are going to be lacking some of the things that are going to be coming up with the web. You know, there's a lot of cool stuff. HTTP2.
Just going to mention that. Yep.
Yeah. Protocols. We started releasing, you know, some of our client sites supporting HTTP2, as well as some of the other things that are in Drupal 8 that are just a major performance enhancing. I mean, for those, have you guys done work with PHP 7 on your sites?
Yeah, I've done a little bit of it, but I don't know all the big advantages of it, to be honest. I just started working with it just because I know that's the next thing.
Yeah.
But I don't know all the big features of it. Did you want to touch on that? That'd be great.
Well, yeah, I can't say that I necessarily talked to all the great all the features.
Oh, just
in,
a few,
in
sure.
PHP 7. But I will I will tell you that one of the great things about it is just the internally, whatever they did, it is incredibly performant compared to, you know, PHP 5.5.6. Like, no kidding. It's about to perform like a typical Drupal bootstrap. It's like one third the time is required. So, like, you can get pages built and returned from a request in literally one third the time that it took you in the past. Exact same view, you know, exact same, like, you can have the exact same kind of like content structure. Like I just cloned a site and just had one on PHP 5 and one on PHP 7, and the performance is just unreal. And of course that's going to impact your SEO and all that. So definitely
kind of cool.
And of course, so getting back to your topic, yeah, all these things are going to be pushing the infrastructure around the website itself are going to be moving forward, and you can't have, you know, like some system that is going to belch a bunch of error messages, you know, and you know, white screen on you just because you're upgrading the underlying infrastructure. You're going to have to upgrade the, you know, the website framework itself.
Yeah, and then there's a lot of great things that have been just added logically to Drupal 8, like Views is in Drupal 8 Core now. What else do you think that people could look at as far as things that made that logical jump into Core that they could look forward to?
Well, the CK editor, which was like, you know, the WYSIWYG editor that was optional in, yeah, you know, back in Drupal 6 and 7, now it's in Core. This is like one of the things, like, it's kind of validating. It's like, hey, all the choices I've been making, the standards for our development, they're all getting put into Core. Yay, you know. So it's like I don't have to relearn some new WYSIWYG thing. A CK.
You don't today.
CK editor, in place editing, and I know that we had talked a little bit about, like, you know, what the future holds for Drupal, or and this is, I think, one of the things as far as out of the box what Drupal itself offers versus other systems out there. But as far as the things that are, like, made it into Core that were contrib, this is actually something that it is still an ongoing battle. There's some very heavy, serious discussions that are going on with regard to it, but I don't know. There's more than just like contrib that gets pulled into Core. There's a bunch of things in D8 Core that did not exist before that are the real selling points to moving to Drupal 8. One of those is like entities, and in Drupal 7 there was, you know, they changed from this concept of nodes to having an entity, which node was kind of like a type of entity. They take that a little farther in Drupal 8, and if you have any experience in Drupal, you know that, like, if you had like a blog, you could add comments to a blog post or something like that. Comments are their own entities now, and as such, you know, you add it as a almost like an entity reference onto your blog post if you want that field available to make comments. You have
Nice.
Yeah, well, and it's nice because you can now, you have more control right out of the box in controlling the way in which the comment is displayed versus the blog post is displayed. If you are familiar with, like, build modes or display modes in Drupal 6 or 7, they have now these display modes, but there's two types. There's like view modes and there's form modes. And I think form modes is one of the things that is for me as a developer, for clients, is the most useful. While view modes, they've been around, you kind of change, you can have different ways in which the content is displayed in different contexts. Mm-hmm. There's also form modes now, which allow you to have different ways in which the editing form is displayed in different contexts.
Hmm.
So there used to be a module called Node Form Columns. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but
yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it allowed you to, like, you know, make a better user interface for your clients. And now all that stuff is kind of built into core, because you can change the form mode and lay out the form the way you want it. You know. Yeah. Other things to not to miss, Big Pipe is in core in Drupal 8. And Big Pipe is going to be a huge performance enhancer. It's basically the technology that Facebook uses to, you know, the way in which Facebook seems to load instantly, you know. When it when Drupal starts rendering the page, typically it would render all the content and then return it. And what it does now is Big Pipe will render all the stuff that is it has no, like, personalization dependencies, like, you know, like, hello Fred, you know, this is your schedule for today, and then there's all this other content which is common to all users. All the content that's common to all users gets sent out, you know, returned immediately, and all the personalized content basically has placeholders. And while all the common content is being sent, Drupal continues to churn and build the personalized content and then streams it into the browser. So it seems like the page from a user experience loads way faster, because it's like, oh, it's full of all this content already. And then here and there you see little personalized content kind of pop in. It really doesn't take any less time, but the experience is way better, you know.
So it's like prioritizing what is loaded, kind of, on the front end.
Yes, exactly. And I'm
can
not
you control
100%,
it?
I was going to say I'm not 100% sure, but I believe that it does it by doing, like, using cache tags, and I think that because of that, if you're a module developer, you can tap into that and specify what should and should not be, you know, a part of that.
Yeah, there has to be some kind of way to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, because Big Pipe...
It won't be popular unless they do it. I mean, you literally just came up with the biggest problem that it would have. If they haven't addressed that, then we won't be talking about Big Pipe ever again, I don't think.
And it'll need Pokemon.
Yeah. Yeah, so let me preface it that I think that Big Pipe is pretty damn cool in that... right out of the box, because it's Drupal core, it's already, like, pre-config. There are no configuration settings. It just goes ahead and figures out, you know, where you've got a dependency on user or something of that nature. So
that's awesome. So, I mean, the one thing that I like to get into as we kind of wind down, Stephen, is you know, obviously you're hugely into tech. You're in an office. You're doing the Dilbert thing now. You know, how do you get back to bikinis and Moat Marine? I mean, like, how do you recharge?
I go away, and I go away for long periods of time.
Where do you go?
Mostly Europe. Every year I try and go for a couple of weeks to Europe. This is, like, one of the ways in which I recharge. I can't say that I necessarily I recharge based on seeing other people excited or coming up with, you know, cool technology. I mean, that kind of enthusiasm and those kinds of, like, cool things are what like inspire me, and that's what kind of, like, gets me interested in moving on. And I mean, as much as I think Drupal 8 has some cool stuff, and we didn't get into it, but there's web services now in core, configuration management, which you can share, and also the way in which it does its release cycle, are so different now. There's some really good ideas. It's not necessarily where I kind of see my future now, and there is a part of me that's a little bored after 10 years, and I'm looking, sure. I am looking at, different things. So,
yeah, I mean, you have to and whatnot, but I mean, like, I'm kind of the same way. If you're excited about a project and I can feign knowledge of that thing, I can pretty much go to task with you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, it's like I can get behind you and I can jump on the train and ride that and get that energy. I mean, passion and, you know, drive and ambition are like the most attractive things to me.
They feed each other, you know.
Yeah, they do, and especially with, like, you know, them playing well into each other and kind of like getting me excited. Like, I'm always hyped, but like I rest it somewhere around about a sloth's energy until I'm ready to release the hounds, as Mr. Burns from The Simpsons would say. Mm-hmm. Fred, that's a cue.
You lied to me. Release the hounds.
that is a good recharge in your day-to-day life. And then I think the other recharge that you're talking about is you know, the trips going off to Europe, being in a different area. You know, interestingly, not saying unplugging from technology. I don't hate it when people say it. I just don't believe it when people say that they unplug from technology, especially people in the tech world.
Yeah.
Like, you don't unplug from technology. It's still there. It's just you may not use it as much or use it for what you're using for before. But if you're still on your phone, if it's still in your pocket, you're not unplugged. You're there.
Yep. You're there.
Yep.
You know, but yeah, it's exactly. It's just nice to hear. You know, for our listeners, I think it's like finding those ways to get recharged in your actual workday is really important. Like the things that get you excited, talk about them. Mm-hmm. Because then people will know that that's the stuff that you like. And like people who can't get a reaction out of you or don't know how to get a rise out of you and stuff like that, or like they think that, you know, it's, you know, this is a dry person. It's like, no, you just don't know what excites me. You know, this is the stuff that excites me. This is the stuff that gets me on board for what you're doing. This is how we're going to work well together.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, if a boss wants to know how to make you happy, all you have to tell him is like, this is what I'm passionate about. Oh, okay. Well, I'm going to hand you this stuff because your passionate work is the work I like the best.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it goes a long way.
Yeah. Well, and also like it can't be simple stuff. Like, you know, if it's, I'll get bored in a second.
Like lamb.
You have to give yourself a nice, good challenge, and then, you know, something about like someone like giving you something that seems pretty daunting, if not impossible, and you coming away looking like a rock star because you pulled it off. That's a major recharge in and of itself. You know.
Yeah. So you were talking about when you like to recharge with different tech that you're interested in. You like to dive into it. Is there anything that particularly inspires you regarding to tech or in general that really help you? Like, what do you do to level up your skills and the like?
Yeah. So I mean, not that I know a lot about some of these things, but these are things that I see as being, you know, like where I saw augmented reality being the future, you know, 10 years ago. Now I'm seeing some of these other things as things that excite me about what the next kind of level is. And that's quantum computing, where it's like the ultimate in parallel computing. You've got the ability to kind of like figure out multiple algorithm variations at the same time, and plasma holograms. I don't know if you've seen these things. So on top of doing Drupal on a daily basis, we also like to, like I said, I don't like boring things. So occasionally we're called on to work on some challenging things. We had it's not an official project, and it may or may not come to pass, but we were called on to do some work for a proposal to develop an interactive experience for a Qing Dynasty courthouse in China, in Chengdu. and
bless you.
Yeah. And they wanted to have like 3D holograms, and I was like, well, you know, that technology doesn't really exist yet, but there are some interesting, you know, alternatives that are out there.
Tupac.
What?
Tupac, oh, yeah. Tupac hologram.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, that's exactly the kind of things that they were looking at. Unfortunately, they're, you know, you couldn't do that in their location. There are some systems out there that create like kind of like a mist that is, it's the size of the water particles are small enough, the micron size, that they actually dry as soon as they touch something, just from the heat of the evaporation rate. Mm-hmm. So it's like a dry mist, and you can project onto it, and you can create, you know, floating hologram looking things out there. But there's also technology out there right now. It's just in its infancy, and they've started to do stuff that makes it more practical. They have these plasma lasers, or actually not plasma lasers, they're, I think, infrared lasers, but they create a plasma where they kind of like intersect, and they create a spot where they focus that will create plasma, just like electricity, like a lightning. So you'll get like a spot of light at a focal point in three-dimensional space. They could not necessarily use it because it is damaging to human skin.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah. I was like, that releasing plasma does not sound like it would ever do anything wrong.
Yeah.
Ever.
Small, no, negative. Not dangerous at all.
Let's start in Trump Towers.
Yeah,
you know?
Or let's,
I mean, just
let's put it in
it's
Disney.
Completely safe.
Yeah, let's put it in a Disney ride.
I'd be happy with just Trump Towers, like specifically his office. While he's there, I mean, he should see it. It's spectacular. It's going to be huge.
Yeah, huge. they figured out part of their problem where they changed upped the recycle rate of the laser so that it would. It's, I think it's called a femtosecond. Like, and I think a femtosecond is like something like 1/1,000,000,000th of a trillionth of a second, or some
quadrillionth of a second. I'm looking at it right now, actually.
Oh, are you? It's like so. Yeah, so small of a cycle rate. But what it does is it makes the plasma, it makes it occur as such a small minute of time that it is not actually damaging to the human skin. And what's really cool is that apparently you can feel it. So
yeah,
we're
I'm reading about it. It feels like
holodecks.
Sandpaper. That's cool.
We're talking about holodecks in about 15, 20 years, you know?
Yeah, and then affordable holodecks somewhere around about 35 to 44.
Yeah.
I'll be old. I'll be old as shit, and then I'll be able to finally do what I've wanted to do, like, for the last 30 seconds, which is say, beam me up, Scotty.
Yep, yeah. Yeah.
And then they'll completely take apart my organs and re-fix them together. But, Steven, I've got to tell you, man, thank you so much for being on the show. I think we're going to close it out here. It's interesting, you know, it's being the difference between, you know, the tech martyr. I hope you get to be the tech evangelist to, like, and see the second coming, as it were, when it happens.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I've got other ideas that we don't have time to get into, nor could I discuss at length. But future of data storage, I think, is something else that's going to be a major change in the next 10 to 15 years.
Those Superman crystals.
No. You know how you can have like a simple algorithm that describes a curve, or like, let's say, a tone, you know, like a cycling tone. There is data there that is basically infinite that's described by a single algorithm. My feelings are that at some point in the future, you're going to be able to create algorithms that replace the storage of every single byte on your computer will not have to be stored necessarily like on disk, or it can be stored in an algorithm. And that's something that I've actually started experimenting with And I think that that will be a major leap for long-term data storage in the future.
Dig it. All right, man. We're definitely going to bring it to a close on storing data. That's going to be an interesting thing. And now you have a point back to. You can be like, I was talking about this then. Now it's digitally there. You can just point everybody back to the Thunder Nerds episode, you know, on this day.
Full circle.
And that happened. Full circle.
Yeah,
all
and
right.
Then somebody
well,
else will,
on.
Then somebody else will have implemented it, and I'll say, fuck you. Yeah.
Indeed it will. Fuck you again. Yeah. I don't want your sour wine apple.
Right, yes, exactly.
If you have a question or topic you'd like us to discuss, send us your text or audio questions at connect@thundernerdsho.com.
Also, hit us up if you're interested in sponsoring the show, and don't forget to pimp us on iTunes with a like or review. Thank you.